Hi, my name is Ruben Carrion, owner operator from Kissimmee, Florida. Quick note before we start, there is a little strong language in this one.
So far on the show, we've talked a lot about the culture of the trucking industry.
It's the freedom of it.
You gotta live it, love it, breathe it, bleed it.
We've heard about the importance of freedom.
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 And autonomy.
I'm my own boss.
Your own boss.
About the pride in getting a job done right.
Do what you gotta do to get the job done.
On your own terms.
This is not insurmountable.
Sometimes, in spite of the rules.
Turn it miles, turn it burn, man.
And often in spite of the personal cost.
Scares the guy a little bit, honestly, though.
Some truckers even like to say that we are like the last American cowboys.
Not dealing with the people.
Living by our own code.
A loner.
Apart from the rest of society.
And doing my own thing and my own rules.
But where did this culture of independence come from?
Okay, I love this subject. We have to go back to food.
So today on the show, we're talking history and also food with some help from author and trucker Finn Murphy.
Let's just dial it to about 1933. That's where it all starts, about food.
Finn's going to help us get to the bottom of this whole mythology of truckers as the last American cowboys. He'll take us on a journey that touches on everything from Humphrey Bogart to the Lord of the Rings, and from Ronald Reagan to Franklin Roosevelt.
Roosevelt's basic problem was, how am I going to boost farm incomes and provide cheap food at the same time? And that's the birthday of the American trucking myth, culture, and everything else that comes from that.
This is Over the Road from PRX's Radiotopia and Overdrive magazine. I'm Long Haul Paul. When you're an over-the-road trucker, part of your job is to cavort with your brethren over coffee, addressing the international geopolitical situation, maybe the breakdown of the modern family, all while hurling invective at your fellow drivers who don't come from the same part of the country as you do. It's pretty much what we do. So you can think of this episode as just that. A good old-fashioned truckers-only counter-discussion between Finn,
wow,
myself, hello. Hey Finn, and my colleague here at Over the Road, the bull hauler's daughter herself.
I know, it's over the top.
Lacey Roberts. This is the type of brisk repartee you used to hear at places like the TV room of the New England truck stop in Sturbridge, Mass.
Gee, I'm a truck driver. I've never been.
The veritable rotating think tank in its day. Or in Kenley, North Carolina, where some drawling denizen of Big Boy's truck stop would expound at length on how all y'all Yankees ruin NASCAR. So consider yourself warned. Things are about to get pretty heady in here. Okay, I admit it. I discovered Finn's book, The Long Haul, while Googling myself, Long Haul Paul. Let's face it, nobody gets to own that phrase, but still, who was this other long haul guy? Two paragraphs in and I was hooked. Man, could that guy write. And as I read the book, I realized just how much Finn and I have in common.
Well, it started when I was about 17 and I worked at a gas station.
Like me, he was a gas jockey.
And next door to the gas station was Callahan Brothers Moving and Storage.
Who looked up to the truckers.
I was sort of in awe of these guys because I could see the sweat sort of caked on their t-shirts.
But like me, Finn decided to go to college.
So that was my summer job as a local mover at Callahan Brothers.
Like me, he got 3 years in.
And then the summer of my junior year, I ran into this long-haul driver named Will Joyce. And I took a road trip with him down to Virginia.
And like me, he dropped out.
I was just bewitched by the whole life, by seeing the country, by the work, and by the money. I decided that I would get my tractor-trailer license and do exactly what my friend Will was doing.
But this is where my story and Finn's diverge. You see, Finn took the high road, in a sense. following Willie Joyce into that most artisanal form of trucking, that of the high-end household mover. He's the guy you call when you need to move an $80,000 collection of Chinese artifacts into your new vacation home in Aspen. Very few truckers out there can do what Finn does. You have to be strong, but also smart and able to mix with the well-heeled clientele. Me, I suppose I wound up on a lower road, pulling reefers, loads of lettuce, pork loins, watermelons, food, that is. My loads took me to the dirty sides of towns, to the old warehouses, to the produce and the meat markets. I was awake when everyone else was asleep with a lucky strike in my hand, seeing what the old Pete could really do in western Kansas, and all of it coming back to food out there with the cow trucks, the chicken haulers, the hopper bottoms laden with grain, rolling through the nameless fields of the great alone.
It all starts about food.
That's what Finn was starting to explain at the top. So let's hear him out.
In the late 19-teens, the food cost for an American household was a significant portion of their annual income. I've seen numbers all over the place, but 40 to 50%, maybe sometimes even higher. So food costs are rising, and you have this nascent trucking industry, and it made it easier for small farmers to get their goods to market.
The tremendous crowds which you see gathered outside the stock exchange.
So let's just dial it to about 1933.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt,
FDR is elected president, and remember now, so we've got a very depressed farm economy, catastrophically depressed now.
Bewildered, they joined the great army of the highway.
And so you had way more trucking and truck capacity than the economy needed at that time, 1933, 34, 35. So the trucking companies were all cutting each other's throats, underbidding freight rates. So we've got this three-headed monster. We have high food prices, we have trucking companies going out of business, and then we have this farm catastrophe all happening at the same time.
In every dark hour of our national life,
the Roosevelt administration came up with a plan.
They regulated the interstate trucking industry.
In these critical days.
The Motor Carrier Act of 1935.
Which is, you know, all of this sounds kind of mundane. And when you, you know, if you ever talk to any trucker, almost everybody's going to know what the Motor Carrier Act of 1935 is. Even if they, you know, even if they have trouble reading or never finish high school, we know about the Motor Carrier Act of 1935. What it did is it regulated all aspects of interstate trucking. It set the freight rates for every single commodity. It was a federal offense to charge less than that. And then it exempted agricultural products because the only place to square that Gordian knot of higher farm incomes with cheaper food is to lower the transportation costs. So they left farm products out of the Motor Carrier Act.
That means starting after 1935, if you hauled steel, say, there was a minimum rate that you had to charge. If you hauled cabbage, you negotiated your own rate directly with the shipper.
I have a quick question. Can you just sort of paint a picture of what a driver's life was like before and after 1935?
Well, there's a great movie. It's called They Drive by Night.
Starring none other than Humphrey Bogart.
We got to try to head him off. Watch out he don't cut into us.
And it's about two independent truck drivers in the 1930s about what their life was like.
I'd be glad to finance it, baby.
Who do you think you're kidding? You couldn't even pay for the headlights. Anything else?
And what their life was like then as independent truck drivers is Humphrey Bogart, he's sleeping under his truck on some country road because the truck breaks down. He's paying too much money to get repairs. He's not getting paid the rate he thought he was going to get paid by the commodity guy who he contracted with.
$300, gentlemen, you're going to pay us now if you don't.
All right, all right.
And he's working too hard for too few dollars.
And then it turned into a good job after 1935, is what you're saying?
It turned into a great job.
At least it turned into a great job for some truckers. And it all started with those fixed freight rates.
So what happened after 1935 is that the trucking companies who had goods that were subject to the Motor Carrier Act, they would go to Washington every year or every 2 years or whatever it was, and then they would lobby for higher freight rates. And then the workers who were driving these trucks realized that these companies were making lots and lots of money.
So those truckers started to organize.
Our distinguished guest for this evening is Dave Beck, General President of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Union, AFL.
By 1940, the Teamsters were the nation's largest union, with nearly 500,000 members.
Largest and most powerful union in the United States.
By 1950, they could claim more than 1 million members.
Now, Mr. Beck, your union controls everything from the delivery of diapers to the driving of a hearse.
So what happened was the Teamsters and the trucking companies together would go to Washington to set the freight rates.
I certainly do work very closely with the business people that employ our membership.
So labor's getting taken care of. The Teamsters doing pretty good contracts for their people.
And I am interested in every industry employing our people.
The trucking companies are getting the profit margins they want because the rates are fixed. So from 1935 to about 1980, all of the people regulated under the Motor Carrier Act were reasonably happy.
We'll very definitely pull out.
Well, thank you very much, Dave Beck, for being with us tonight.
And then that left the drivers, the truck drivers, hauling agricultural goods, who had none of that safety net at all.
Why in the world would you haul agricultural products after 1935? Who was doing that, and why, and how?
There's a lot of people that don't want to punch a time clock. There's a lot of people that don't want to be told what to do on a day-to-day basis. And they're not going to become a Teamster because they would view that as giving up a certain amount of personal American autonomy. And those were the people that became the agricultural freight haulers, called wildcatters, called independents. There's a lot of different names for them. But those people, they would buy their own truck, and then they would find their own loads. A lot of times just driving up to farms, but a lot of time driving up to, you know, wholesalers or things like that, picking up a load of watermelons or, you know, what have you, negotiate a rate with that shipper, deliver the item, and then get paid for that. And then do it again and do it again. But there was a higher level of independence for sure.
For many truckers, this wasn't some cultural choice you made between becoming a Teamster and becoming an independent or wildcatter. Often it just came down to where you were from. If you grew up in the rural South or Midwest, where there wasn't much to ship besides beans, corn, and cows, no one around there was going to give you a union card. But before we go any deeper into the history, I want to pause for a more personal take on all this from one of my heroes.
I'm getting too old and forgetful. I'm 93, you know.
Someone who actually lived the life.
The old jailhouse and floor for a bed. You know who is guilty, you know it too well.
An old wildcatter from back in the day. Retired Indiana trucker and unfiltered World War II veteran. The Theldon Thornburg.
You know, back in them days, you didn't have turn signals on.
So
the only turn signals you had was your arm signal, and you just placed your lights. but it didn't have no front wheel brakes. It didn't have no shock absorbers.
Theldon was an independent trucker during this exact period we're talking about.
I got fired 3 times from dispatchers at Craig's.
He didn't want to punch a time clock.
I've always hated the union.
Or joined the Teamsters, who over time got the reputation of being corrupt.
You can't do what you want to do. You got to do what they want you to do.
He'd take loads that other truckers wouldn't take.
I hauled the first loads up the old Jacob's Ladders.
Down roads where other truckers wouldn't go.
A lot of people died there because it was so steep.
And he had no interest in being regulated in any fashion.
Throw them damn logbooks away.
So I stopped by Theldon's house one morning to cook him breakfast.
Now, when did you start driving when you were in the service? Or
and Theldon tells us his story.
The day I was 21 years old, I got out of the service and I started driving for Ellis Trucking. And I drove there for, I don't know, a year or two. Then I started wildcatting.
Back in the 1950s and 60s, Theldon was one of those independent truckers Finn talked about. But he didn't just haul agricultural products. He was a true wildcatter, meaning he'd haul steel, paper, dry goods, anything he could get in the wagon. And he'd give an under-the-table discount to the freight rates set by the Interstate Commerce Commission. That's what wildcatting was.
Back in them days, there was quite a few wildcatters, and we didn't haul anything that was legal. Everything was illegal. But you can make good money because ICC had high rates on stuff, and you hauled it for cheaper. But if you got caught, you was in trouble.
Dalton had a truck he called Big Al.
Big Al. It was a power liner with 700 or 800 horsepower.
The name was a reference to its rare Alice Chalmers motor.
They only made 50 of them.
The motor itself was painted all in purple. Truckers called it the Purple People Eater.
In its day, it'd pass anything that was on the road, even if you was overloaded. One time I got arrested at a scale just before you got to the Continental Divide.
He and another driver got busted up there for being overweight.
And me and that guy had breakfast together. I was 5,000 pounds heavier than he was. So he said, I'm going to show you the way up over that Continental Divide. And I said, you do that. So I hung back behind, let him think he was getting a jump on me, you know. When I went past him, I was going about 40 miles an hour faster than he was. And the time I got up over the mountain, I had him out of sight.
But here's what I respect the most about Theldon. Yes, he drove fast. Yes, he broke the rules. But he did those things out of a profound sense of personal responsibility.
I ain't taking nothing to keep me awake except oranges. And that's all I ever did use. I'd buy me a whole pack of big navel oranges down there in Florida. And time I'd get to Sweetgrass, I'd have about 2 left.
In fact, he prided himself on his safety.
If you was wildcatting, you didn't have no insurance, but you was careful.
He was governed by an interior code.
The amount of safety that you got is within yourself, not the truck. And I drove a damn truck 5,200,000 miles and never did have a chargeable accident.
For Theldon, it was all distilled down to taking care of the load, doing what you'd said you'd do, looking a man in the eye and giving him your word you'd be there.
Some of us like to work.
Logbooks, scale masters, speed limits were all just impediments, obstacles that had to be circumvented.
I wish I could still work because I enjoy working.
I wanted you to hear all that from Theldon so you can understand where the culture around independent trucking comes from. Guys like Theldon, who flat love to work hard and do things their own way, and in part because of the Motor Carrier Act of 1935, that culture comes from rural America, because that's where there was food to be hauled. Things were different around the cities, along the coasts where Teamsters were most dominant. But all that was about to change.
We restored competition to the marketplace, and I take some satisfaction that this deregulation legislation...
So after the break, we pick up our conversation with Finn Murphy, and we'll hear how the whole regulatory system that Theldon grew up in was turned on its head.
That each generation of Americans has a rendezvous with a different reality.
And in a sense, we all became wildcatters. So Finn told us about the Motor Carrier Act of 1935 and how it basically split trucking into two parallel industries, agricultural and non-agricultural. That all changed in 1980. But before we get to that, let's take a little road trip through time.
In this century, America has become a nation on wheels.
After World War II, trucking quickly overtook rail as a dominant mode of freight transport.
On wheels to bring us the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the things we use. But when we depend on wheels, we depend also on highways.
In 1956, the Eisenhower administration started work on the interstate system.
Congress responded with the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956. Providing the staggering sum of
with the interstate, a cross-country trip that used to take weeks could be run in mere days.
It'll be possible to drive from the Atlantic to the Pacific Oceans and from Canada to Mexico without a single stoplight or stop sign.
And the trucks were changing too.
7.5 tons of custom forged steel.
They had power steering, air ride seats. Essentially, the job became a lot easier and a lot more comfortable.
It can pull a 40-foot trailer loaded with 76,000 pounds of cargo 850 miles without refueling.
By the time the 1970s were in full swing, there were more than 4 million heavy trucks working in America.
Yeah, Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on.
They were all over popular culture, too.
Mercy sakes alive, looks like we've got us a convoy.
With truckers often portrayed as cowboys and outlaws.
With a truckload of bootleg beer.
This is Bandit 1, and that is Bandit 2.
Part of the same mythology we've been talking to Finn Murphy about.
The only time clock they've got to punch, the one in their heads. Because out in the road, they're on their own.
The reality, though, was that most truckers didn't fit the cowboy description. For most, trucking was simply a decent middle-class job.
With solid benefits, with pensions. In certain ways, it was the golden age of truck driving and for trucking companies.
But the whole industry and culture of trucking took a big turn leading up to the 1980s.
The rub, of course, and this is how the deregulation juggernaut got going, is that consumer prices just kept rising because transportation costs just kept rising. And there's a big groundswell to lower consumer prices. And the best way to do that, according to some people in the government, was getting rid of the supports that we've already talked about.
A strange coalition came together to push for deregulation of the trucking industry. It included some independent truckers who were hoping for more freedom in what freight they could legally haul. But it also included some of the regulators themselves, consumer advocates, manufacturers of all shapes and sizes, and of course the retailers who bought stuff from them. Together, they took their concerns to legislators in Washington.
To say, essentially, the Roosevelt administration is still running the trucking industry, and we need to bring competition into trucking. And they did.
While others talked of free enterprise, it was the Democratic Party that acted, and we ended excessive regulation in the airline and trucking industry.
And that's when the Motor Carrier Act of 1980 came in, and freight rates were gotten rid of completely.
Together, we have cut the growth of new federal regulations nearly in half.
In the end, the independent truckers who favored deregulation got what they wanted, too.
So now anybody in America could haul any item for any price that they could negotiate with the person paying to ship them.
So let's dial back to 1980. Deregulation has occurred. And can you talk about how the entire trucking industry changed in 1980?
Yeah. So overnight, we went right back to 1934. Before 1980, while trucking rates were being regulated and updated every couple of years, there was no incentive to thin out management ranks. There was no incentive to save fuel. There was no incentive not to buy new trucks every couple of years. There was no incentive not to do whatever the Teamsters wanted you to do. And that just doesn't go for movers. That goes for everything that was being transported in the United States. And then the day after deregulation, I'm still charging $175 an hour for 2 men in a truck. And then the mover next door says, I'm going to charge you $150 an hour. And then the mover next door to him says, I'm going to charge you $130 an hour. And the mover next door says, I'm going to charge you $100 an hour. So the freight rates basically were cut in half overnight. And the big, big freight companies that were stuck with a lot of management and these Teamster contracts were going bankrupt.
The American labor movement as a whole is struggling, just trying to hold its own.
There's no doubt union companies took a beating after 1980.
You hit a low point. There's no question about that.
That's one reason union membership has been dropping to less than 19% of the workforce last year.
But it wasn't all bad. Independent truckers and startup companies could now get official authority to haul stuff like steel and paper. Freight that guys like Theldon used to only haul under the table.
Mr. Garrison foresaw the opportunity that would come from deregulation in the trucking industry and decided to get back in the business.
This change spawned a whole new class of entrepreneurs who could get in the game and compete with the big fleets.
Set out on a journey. They began American Freightways, which has grown today to a $1 billion organization with 17,000.
Remember Will Joyce? Finn's friend, who got him into trucking in the first place. Well, he was one of those entrepreneurs. In 1981, Joyce started his own company, Joyce Van Lines, with just 2 trucks, and quickly grew it into a nationwide operation.
People like Will Joyce, who came after 1980, who were not saddled with union employees, those are the guys that won.
As NBC's Mike Jensen reports tonight, this is a trend that union leaders are battling.
The days of the automatic raise, every time a contract comes up, seem to be over. The government says
plenty of everyday drivers did just fine after deregulation. But the broad picture mirrors the rest of the working world. We all seem to be working more and more for less and less.
Actually took pay cuts, averaging about 10%.
This union is about the membership, the forgotten people, good contracts, decent pensions.
1985, lower than the inflation rate.
Here's the hard truth of it all. Truckers' average take-home pay in 1980 was just shy of $40,000 a year. That kind of money would be worth more than $110,000 today. You can find truckers who pull 6 figures these days, but they're not exactly the rule. and the average take-home pay is nowhere even close. Between $50,000 or $60,000 for company drivers, and up closer to $70,000 for owner-operators. Okay, but I do want to get back to culture here. What happens to the culture of trucking after 1980?
Well, that's a great question, because the union drivers that I knew on the East Coast back in those 70s and stuff had a different way of conducting themselves and comporting themselves and dressing themselves. I'm a professional. I'm a middle-class guy. I'm not one of those guys, meaning the independent wildcatter down at the truck stop. And he's the guy hauling the agricultural goods who's got the rural roots. He's either from the Midwest or the South. He doesn't want to work in a factory. He doesn't want to punch a clock for the Teamsters. He wants to kind of run his own business. He's the one who sees himself as a latter-day American cowboy. And he's the one who's wearing the cowboy hat and the cowboy boots and the big belt buckle and the plaid shirt and talking real loud to the waitress in the coffee counter. That's great. That's fine. But what happened after deregulation was those professional guys, the union guys, the hourly guys, they didn't have anything left, because what they used to do to put their chest out was, I'm a Teamster and I'm middle class. When those two things disappeared, they're just another sharecropper on the road like everybody else, getting paid by the mile. So as the union and professional middle class men began to disappear, the other truck drivers that are working for other companies, they adopt the cowboy myth. Because now they're living in the same penury and misery that the independents were. I totally get it. To a certain extent, I agree with it. I have to be something, and something that can make me feel good. And so therefore, I'm going to be the last American cowboy.
Can I just poke at this a little bit more? Because I think that you've explained it very well. But this is this myth of the cowboy is something that me and Paul have been talking about a lot. And I still don't get it. Like, I just don't understand why the drive to being independent is enough to make you live in poverty like that, you know, in the way that you describe.
Okay, well, I think a lot of these drivers, remember now, coming from the rural Midwest and the rural South and the rural West. So these people have already seen what government intervention has done in the farm business, in the railroad business. There's an anti-statist, anti-union bias built in to these folks that goes way before any sort of cultural wars. This goes back to what they consider to be the pioneer guys in the Conestoga wagons, making their own way in the world. This is who I am.
So. I want to speak to what your point a little bit, because I am a rural Midwesterner who in so many ways does embody nearly everything you say. And there is something about the circumvention of the law that becomes a drug. And then all of a sudden, you know, a guy says, well, I just went down to Florida with 107,000 pounds, Dodge scales all the way, made $3,500 clear. And like, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And that becomes a thing. It becomes a peer dependent thing. And it does become its own culture.
If you were to do a roster of CB handles from truck drivers, you know, the three most popular names are going to be Outlaw, Lone Ranger, and Bandit. And that just underscores what Paul was saying is, you know, we're giving the middle finger to the rest of society. We're living in our own society here.
As you can probably tell, Finn does kind of look down on the whole cowboy trucker culture. I mean, you don't show up to move the CEO of a Fortune 500 company all dressed up like Yosemite Sam. That just won't fly. But the funny thing is, even as he eloquently deconstructs trucks, the myth. I know he's never completely divorced from it, so here's what I do. In our interview, I read Finn one of my favorite passages from his book, The Long Haul, where he drives all the way down to Key West, only to discover that his load has been given to another carrier. And you get screwed out of a load, and you call your dispatcher, Gary. It turns out that his dispatcher, Gary, has sent him on a 500-mile wild goose chase. Naturally, Finn is furious. And this is what he says. You say, I pity you, Gary. You know what I just figured out about truck drivers? For all their pitiful myths, most of them do this stupid job for one reason. They can look themselves in the eye and honestly say they've held to their own standards without caving into pressure by society or somebody else's expectations. They might fuck up, and they do, but they own their fuck-ups and keep to those standards regardless of the personal cost. I'm a truck driver, too. Fuck you, Gary. Keep your split level in Fort Wayne. Raise your kids to become cogs in the machines. I live by a different standard that I just figured out. All these cowboys I've looked down upon, they're better than you for all their faults. And here we are, we're what now, 39 years after 1980, and yet this seems to be the thing that we all grapple with, is living by our own codes, our own standards. And can you speak to that, Finn?
I have to tell you, the chills went down my spine, because, I mean, it's just, it's sort of a declaration of an anthem, which I hold. And you're right, I'm completely ambivalent about the myth. I mean, I can excoriate it on the one hand, but then I'm also bound up with it too. It's like Gollum in The Ring, you know. Gollum hated the Ring of Power, but he loved it too. And I'm trucking for me is kind of the same way. I like, you know, weirdos. I like people with opinions. I like people that have done something different with their lives, and I like to hear about it. I like to talk to those people. I like to be around those kinds of people. And you can still find those people in trucking, because if you can't fit anywhere else, you can fit where you don't have to fit at all, and that's as an independent driver. So, yeah, it is a place for people that can't quite toe the line in certain other ways, and it's going to be a tragedy when it goes.
Day after talking to Finn, I've got a load of milk to haul. And Lacey rides along.
Now, where is your cup?
It's here. Talk a little bit about the importance of coffee to a truck driver.
It's like we're all just in search for the strongest coffee possible. We believe that there's no such thing as coffee that's too strong. There's just people that are too weak.
Find ourselves in the agricultural mecca of West Central Ohio, hauling by silos, steeples, cattle, and fields.
Yeah, wow, no kidding, you make this strong.
Was that too strong?
Nope. I'm not too weak, Paul.
Well, I wasn't suggesting. There's no shame in saying it's too strong. That doesn't mean you're
there
weak.
There is definitely shame in saying it's too strong. What are you talking about?
When Finn talks about those people who can't quite toe the line in society, he's talking about guys like me, those shiftless ne'er-do-wells who never quite fit in.
It's just out here on this lonesome old farm, picking up a load of milk, dropping off an empty trailer.
Trucking gave me a place in the world. It took my family out of grinding poverty. It gave me the best friends that I have on this earth. And like Finn said at the end there, it feels like it's all starting to disappear. electronic logs, digital freight apps, the kind of stuff we've been talking about the last couple episodes, not to mention the onboard cameras and autonomous trucks. These things are changing the culture of trucking, for better or for worse.
It's really coming down hard.
So as we drive down the road, I tell Lacey this story about one of those old friends of mine and the culture that we shared.
Kevin was my old boss. He overheard me playing my guitar in the terminal. And he asked me what song that was. I said, it's one I wrote. He said, well, what are you doing with that messed up guitar? Because I had accidentally sat on this guitar that my daughter gave me. I threw it in the sleeper and I was tired one night. I sat on it and I broke it.
No.
Held together by duct tape.
Oh no, that sucks.
Bailing wire. He goes, what are you doing with that messed up guitar? And this is what I got, man.
2 weeks later, Kevin gave me this beautiful black Epiphone guitar. And all he asked was that I play a few songs for the boys in the warehouse.
But Kevin was an old produce hauler. And he and I understood each other. The bond of thieves and bandits. When we did these things.
''1989. Diesel was just a dollar, so we came from the hills and hollers just to work that broken line, see you take your truck. With a big block mechanical commons, souping up till it was humming, just like them old boys running sham. We burned them second morning Detroit, Salas, Salinas. Was a bond of thieves and bandits we bowled between us. It was the golden age of the good old boy.
Tell you another thing about my buddy Kevin. He's from Kentucky, and he has strong opinions about which truck stop has the best nanner pudding on I-75.
No matter how much you ate, no matter how full you was, you had to get nanner nanner pudding to go.
So in our next episode, we're going to settle that age-old question once and for all.
And believe it or not, we have drove from Dayton, Ohio to the 49er for nanner pudding. That's good nanner pudding. You couldn't beat it.
We're taking a tour of my favorite Kentucky truck stops, where we'll also meet my favorite singing waitress.
Keep yourself busy and make that 12 hours go by real quick.
Catch you next time, over the road.
It just takes one too many straight shots to Miami. One too few nights in my own bed. They had to carry me back home to Indiana. Seven broken bones left these scars upon my head. And now it's all 19. I'm a little hobbled when I walk in. Little cut back on my top end. I'm just trying to stay out of the way, but my record's clean. And they tell me that I'm compliant. It's more like a too old to be defiant, though I still dream about those days. Well, there used to be a quiet understanding. When all else failed, you run that freight on town. Now I'm busted on the cruel backside of Banning. Some triple digit large car in my mind.
Our Over the Road Pit crew includes producer and sound designer Ian Koss and contributing producer Lacey Roberts at Transmitter Media. Our editor from Overdrive Magazine is Todd Dills. Our digital producer is Aaron Wade. Our project manager is Audrey Martovich. And our executive producer for Radiotopia, Julie Shapiro. I'm Long Haul Paul. All the music on the show is by Ian Koss and myself, featuring performances by Travis the Snake Man Womack, Terry Two Socks Richardson, Tisha Mingo Jim Whitehead, Jan Grant Gullett, the late great Roger Clark, and Mr. Andrew Marshall. Special thanks this week to my fellow writing trucker, Finn Murphy. The full title of his book is The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. I've read it 3 times, listened to it about 5 times. The voices you heard at the top of the show belong to Devray Jones, Mike Landis, Kenyette Godhigh Bell, Mississippi Tim, Jared Sidlow, Jason Earlywine, and a trucker in Dallas who introduced himself only as Rattlesnake. For further reading on the subject of trucking history, check out Shane Hamilton's Trucking Country, The Road to America's Walmart Economy. Find Todd's Distillation of Owner-Operator History, written on the occasion of Overdrive's 50th anniversary in 2011, via overdriveonline.com/breakingfree. Over the Road is made possible by support from folks I have worked for a really long time, Moeller Trucking, now celebrating over 30 years of safe and reliable transportation for the food industry. For more information, check out MoellerTrucking.com. Over the Road is a collaboration between Overdrive Magazine and PRX's Radiotopia, a collection of the best independent podcasts around. I just listened to the Kitchen Sisters on PRX Remix this morning while I was detailing my truck. The episode was entitled No Tongue Can Tell, and it just gutted me. I mean, it reduced me to tears on the back 40 of an Ohio truck terminal. I don't even think there's a word for the medium the Kitchen Sisters pioneered on this network, but I call it sonic literature. Seriously, if you're into this quirky, off-the-wall stuff, find out more about the whole network at radiotopia.fm. Look for Overdrive Magazine at overdriveonline.com, where you can read Todd's Channel 19 blog, hear the Overdrive Radio podcast, and explore news, business, and lifestyle reporting about trucking. You can find Over the Road online at overtheroad.fm. Be sure to follow us on all those usual platforms too, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Over the Road Pod. You can see some of my videos on YouTube by looking for Long Haul Paul Music. Thanks for listening, hanging in to the end of the run. We'll be back next week with more stories from Over the Road.
So you raced James Dean. How did that go?
Well, James Dean, he lived in Fairmount, and he ordered a new Indian Chief, and then he spent more money souping it up than what he paid for the Indian. So then I went over there with my old Harley, and I just had an old 61. And so when I was over there, they wanted to pick a race out of me. I said, well, it's all the money you spent on, there ain't no use wasting. I wouldn't have a chance. So they called me chicken shit. I said, there's one thing I ain't chicken shit. So we got out there and I just peeled the hell out of him.
Thanks for listening to Over the Road. Another Radiotopia show you might like is Everything is Alive. Host Ian Chillog is coming back with the 3rd season on March 18th. And yes, it has been a bit, but it's worth the wait. Great performers like Tammy Sager and Jason Mantzoukas will be bringing objects like a chainsaw, leather pants, and an Oxford shirt to life. Here, take a listen.
Well, Why don't we have you introduce yourself for us?
Well, what's your name?
My name is Ian.
My name is Ian. I'm a mirror.
I'm Louise. I'm a shirt.
I'm William, and I'm a pants.
You're just pants. You're not a pants.
Right. I'm pants, and you are shirt.
So my name's Josh. I am a chainsaw. I don't think I have any friends. I mean, when a chainsaw shows up at a party, you know, something has gone awry.
Are you just saying your name is Ian because my name is Ian?
Well, I'm not sure what my name would be otherwise.
What if no one is standing in front of you?
Then I wouldn't be talking.
Do you like being ironed?
Do I like being ironed?
Yeah.
People don't really get ironed.
Yeah, people don't get ironed, William. That's why people wrinkles never go away.
You should try getting ironed. I think you'd look great.
Everything is Alive is a show Time Magazine called Laugh Out Loud Funny, surprisingly informative and often moving. Subscribe to Everything is Alive wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia. From PR.